You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Susan Orlean grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and studied literature and history at the University of Michigan. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her books include Rin Tin Tin, Saturday Night, The Orchid Thief, which was adapted into the Academy Award-winning film adaptation, one of my favorite movies, and directed by Spike Jonze, starring Nicolas Cage and Meryl Streep. Susan's most recent book, we all know it, the library book, has received the most amazing reviews I think I may have ever read. Yes. The Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, a constant pleasure to read. Everybody who loves books should check out the library book. Captivating and delightful. Exquisitely written, consistently entertaining, mesmerizing, riveting. Here's my favorite from the Washington Post. A dazzling love letter to a beloved institution and an investigation into one of the greatest mysteries from the best-selling author hailed as a national treasure. Wow, that's pretty great. And I'm very happy to announce, I just told some of our major supporters a moment ago in the courtyard that Susan Orlean has agreed to chair our Stay Home and Read a Book Ball this year. So we all get to stay home and read a book in support of the library. And Susan's going to be sending us a letter about why it matters. And I'm equally excited to say that one of our distinguished board members from the Library Foundation, Attica Locke, is going to be the interlocutor tonight. And Attica's Pleasantville was the 2016 winner of the Harper Lee Prize for Legal Fiction. It was also longlisted for the Bailey's Prize, I think it used to be called the Orange Prize, for women's fiction, and made numerous bestseller lists. Her first novel, Blackwater Rising, I've read them all, I love them, they have a special shelf in my office, was nominated for an Edgar Award, an NAACP Image Award, as well as the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Her second book, The Cutting Season, a national bestseller and the winner of the Ernest Gaines Award for Literary Excellence, she won the 2018 Edgar Award for her most recent work, Bluebird, Bluebird, the first African-American woman writer ever to win it. She's unstoppable, like Susan, and she's the writer and producer on the Fox drama Empire. She's just completed her work with Ava DuVernay on an upcoming project on the Central Park Five, and that will be released on the 30th anniversary. It's 30 years since that terrible tragedy in April 2019, and she's served on the board of the Library Foundation, I'm proud to say, since 2011, a native of Texas, the mother of a 12-year-old, fabulous young woman. And I want to end with just saying that it's been one of the great pleasures of working for a library and working in support of a library is to work with authors like Susan and like Attica, because they represent not only the honesty and the values, but also the generosity which I associate with the American people. There are no two writers that I know who are more exemplary of that feeling that when they learn something that they think is interesting, they share it with all of us. And the good news is that Susan's book, the library book, has just finished its second printing. So we are welcoming two great authors once again to the stage of the Library Foundation, Susan Orlean and Attica Locke.
Thanks, Kevin. Hello, everybody. I just want to take a moment first to talk about this building. It occurs to me that certainly, obviously, none of us would be here without the building, but also that this book wouldn't exist if you had not, several years ago, walked inside of it. And I would wonder if you could take us back to the day when you walked into this building for the first time and what that felt like and what it spoke to in you.
I was newly arrived in Los Angeles, and even though I had spent a lot of time here over the years, I had never come downtown, and frankly, I doubted there was a downtown.
There is.
And by the same token, I wasn't convinced that there was a library in Los Angeles, let alone a library in this mythical downtown.
Yes.
Of Los Angeles. Certainly, I never imagined that it looked like this.
Yes.
Building. And it's not just that it's, it doesn't look like any library. It doesn't look like the New York Public Library. Mm. It doesn't look like the Cleveland Public Library, which was the library I grew up knowing. It was like coming upon someone's fantasy.
Yeah.
Down here. And walking in, really, it was a profound moment.
Yeah.
I walked in and felt that the walls were speaking. It just, mm-hmm. It felt like every turn you made in the building, there was another interesting element. And this is an architectural wonder.
Yes.
It really is quite exceptional. And the fact is, it is the work of a team of creative geniuses.
Yeah.
Who came together and made this place. And it was a very unusual kind of building. Most libraries were built like big temples, rather austere and serious.
Mm-hmm.
And this was almost as if a group of people got together and said, what's the craziest way we can make this building? So being in it really had.
Yes.
A huge effect on me. It wasn't just that I was walking around and seeing a beautiful building, but I really felt that it was resonant with stories.
I feel that way too, and I think I find this building kind of holy. I mean, and first of all, I think that libraries right now in our lives, this is the highest form of civilization. The free exchange of ideas and free information for citizens, I can't think of any more important kind of tool for the country, and particularly at this time. You know, the idea that...
Right.
I always think that libraries are the one government building where you can go in with, you're not somebody's problem.
And I think, yes, exactly.
I mean, it's not the DMV.
And if you are a problem, nobody's going to tell anybody.
Correct.
That you're a problem.
Correct.
So there's a kind of benign presence that a library.
Yes.
Has that nobody here is charged with the responsibility of telling you cheated on your taxes.
Right.
Or you didn't register your car properly.
No, they just answer all your questions. It's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing. And I want to talk about the meaningfulness of libraries. I just came back from doing a series of library events in my hometown of Houston. And several of the libraries there were still recovering from Harvey. And so that they had gone after Hurricane Harvey. There were communities that had no library for nearly, it's been a year, for nearly a year had no library. And I was, one of the things that you, there was a quote that you had in the book that just kind of almost brought tears to my eyes about what the loss of a library does to a community. It's the quote that in Senegal, the polite expression for saying someone has died is to say that his or her library has burned. I mean, what a great metaphor and parallel for what libraries mean as a storehouse of information, but stories and souls and all this kind of stuff. And I wonder if there was more that you maybe wanted to add to this, what a library means psychologically in a community, because you also talked about war and what.
Right.
Happens during wars and libraries.
One of the things I found really interesting, and the reason that quote to me became this sort of touchstone for the book, was that libraries are communal brains.
Yeah.
This is the unit of the library is essentially replicates the structure of our own brains.
Mm.
It's filled with memories and information, these units that have been stored and are there to be retrieved. When a library is destroyed, it's as if the brain of a community.
Mm-hmm.
Has been devastated, much the way that when someone dies or someone loses his or her memory, an entire library's worth of individual memory and information is lost.
Yeah.
And that's why I became fascinated by the idea that libraries do what we as human beings can't possibly do, which is to place a stake in eternity, to last forever, to maintain those memories and those stories forever the way an individual cannot. And of course, it was a bittersweet notion for me because I was writing the book. My mother was the person who really made me love libraries, and I spent my entire childhood visiting libraries with her. And she had developed dementia around the time that I first began working on this book. And over the course of the book and the process of writing the book, her memories vanished. And to lose the content of of thought and recollection struck me as a kind of deep grief that made me also understand why communities are so devastated and why burning libraries has been a tool of war for so long. I mean, there's nothing particularly valuable about burning down a library. If you're waging war, it's not a strategic target.
But it's a soul hit.
Yes, and I think that it was meant to be a statement that we are erasing you as a people. I also had this thought yesterday, and I wish I'd thought of it about a month ago so I could have put it in the book. I can't imagine that there's a culture that has burned books that hasn't also engaged in genocide. I'd be very interested if someone's a historian and can prove me wrong, but I think the statement of burning the books of a particular culture within your community is a kind of violence and a statement of obliteration that is never done idly. The amount of book burning that has been done over the course of history is unimaginable. I mean, when I was trying to add up the number of books that were destroyed just in World War II, it made me think, I can't believe there were any books left in the world. There were millions upon millions of books, and they were burned intentionally. The Nazis had a squad that were called the Bren Commandos, and they were given the responsibility of seeking out libraries and burning them. And, you know, when you think about it, what an interesting way to use manpower in a war, except if you're trying to say a statement, which is, you don't exist. First your books go, then you go.
And the parallel that you draw in the book, the tender parallel about your mother's illness and losing her losing her memories is a way that you lose memories too. Because if we don't have another person sometimes to mirror our own experiences back to us, it kind of goes away. I have a young niece who lost her father at a young age, and there's certain things she just doesn't remember anymore because her father's not there to like say, oh no, you weren't wearing the red hat, you were actually wearing the yellow hat.
Right.
And so when we lose people who share our memories, we lose sometimes access to those memories.
Well, and I think that's because storytelling is transactional. Mm-hmm. It's not merely meant to be flowing in one direction. It is sent out into the world and it's received. That's what makes it a circuit rather than simply being a flare of information that isn't received. The idea that there isn't someone on the other side receiving it makes you feel as if it doesn't exist. It doesn't make that connection. And that is the purpose of books, is to make the connection with someone else, to have someone else hear your story and to understand your story.
And to have it written down, being somebody who comes from Southern kind of oral traditions, the greatest thrill of my life as a writer is just that stuff is written down. Mm-hmm. Like, that is so meaningful because all the great stories and stuff that I heard from my ancestors and great-grandparents and this, it was all just oral tradition. And so I'm echoing your sentiment of the violence of the burning of a library.
Yeah.
And I want to come to the day of, and the I was telling Susan, you know, I write crime. Your chapter on the fire, where everybody's just chilling in the library, and it's just a regular day, like, and all of a sudden Die Hard breaks out. Like, it literally read like an action film thriller. I'm like, people, y'all get out. Stuff is happening. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I'm like talking to the book, trying to get people to get out. But I don't know how you did that. I don't know how you synthesized. There were so many things happening in different parts of the building. People finding out, people on such and such a floor knew what was happening before people on another floor. There were the firefighters over here. First of all, how did you gather all of this? And then what crazy murder board, beautiful mind thing did you create in order to make a narrative thriller out of it, essentially?
I was lucky enough to come across several, first of all, the fire department's literally minute-to-minute journal of the fire, and it was rather dry. It was like we attached hose number 7 to standpipe number 3. So it wasn't juicy, but it gave me the kind of through line of what was actually happening. I also had the insurance board's analysis, which was also kind of moment to moment.
How did they even do that? Like, they're not in the middle of a fire taking note. I mean,
I think they are. Oh. I think that it's very much part of the protocol of the fire department to record what they're doing and what engines are being deployed and which firefighters are being deployed. And so they're recording it all, I guess, for us writers, so that eventually we can write a book and have all that material, because I'm not exactly sure why else they would do it. But this insurance report was also incredibly detailed. And then I interviewed a lot of the firefighters who were here. Eventually, it was so much in my mind of fire. The fire seemed to me to be this living thing.
It reads like that, yes.
And it was almost as if someone had let loose an animal in the building that was eating its way through the contents of the building. And it was very animated to me. Mm-hmm. It was also really fun to try to write it in a way that gave you a sense of how dramatic it was, how fierce, how intense this fire was. It reached 2,500 degrees. It was melting steel. The shelving in the stacks melted and collapsed and threw the books down into the fire. It just crumpled. It was amazing that the building, because it had thick, thick concrete walls, was relatively unharmed. It was the contents that were devastated, but the building actually made its way through relatively well. Although it was very funny, the other day I was in the library and we were in a room, I can't even remember now what room, and we were looking up and I noticed a hole in the ceiling and suddenly realized it was probably one of the holes that the fire department had drilled in order to allow some of the hot air to escape. And that was actually one of the only ways they were able to get the fire under control. There was a point when the fire department did actually believe this was a lost cause. They didn't know if they were going to be able to put it out before the building was destroyed. It was the largest structural fire in the history of LA until quite recently. Mm. It was the largest library fire in the history of the United States, and one hopes that remains a record that isn't broken. 400,000 books destroyed, 700,000 damaged.
Yeah.
So it was more than half the collection that was it's affected.
It's kind of almost hard to hold it, like actually.
Well, it's, I mean, the numbers are so vast. And one of the things, in a strange way, is makes you appreciate how many books there are in the library. But entire sections were gone. Like the entire cookbook section, which was at that time one of the biggest in the United States, was all gone. The entire collection was gone. The Patton collection, which was the only one west of the Mississippi at the time, and those were all the details on all of the U.S. and Canadian patents, all gone, the entire collection. The fire would linger in a place. It destroyed all the fiction with authors A through L. So that's why I'm glad my name starts with an O. But, you know, it lingered and consumed these entire collections.
One of my favorite anecdotes was you trying to burn a book to get the feel of what does it look like when a book burns. And the book you chose was?
Fahrenheit 451. I felt, I mean, and I had a hard time picking a book.
Yeah.
And first of all, I have to say, I did not write this as a prescriptive. I am not suggesting you burn a book. But I was fascinated by how repugnant the idea was.
Yeah.
And how it, in a way, informed my emotion about the destruction of books, which is, it's not just an object, it's not just paper. We feel the essence of humanity,
yes,
in a book. Otherwise, it would be very easy to throw a book out that you're not going to read again. And nobody does that.
Right.
We just don't do it. It's almost a taboo.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I want to burn a book to kind of explore that emotion and also just to see what it looks like. And I thought, well, I could burn a book that I don't like. And then I thought, that seems so wrong. You know, it just seemed almost wrong. And then I thought, well, then I'll burn a book I like. And then I thought, but I don't want to burn a book I like. So for a while, I thought, well, I'll burn one of my books. And then I thought, that just seems doubly wrong. And I thought, I'm not going to do this. I just can't do this. I can't figure it out. I can't do it. And then my husband one day walked into the house with a big grin on his face and handed me a copy of Fahrenheit 451. And I thought, and just to add to the irony, all of Ray Bradbury's books were destroyed in the fire.
Oh,
because,
really?
Yes, they were all shelved in the fiction section.
In the bees.
Oh, no. And they were all destroyed. So I thought, I think he would appreciate this. And also, it was the new edition that has a matchbook on the cover. And I thought, they're begging me to burn this. So.
What did it feel like?
Well, it was weird. I was really resisting. It felt so strange. Finally, I thought, all right, I'm going to do this. I just want to, and it'll be useful for the book. And I lit a match. I held it up to the cover, and it was as if the book exploded. It burned like that. It was literally the fire traveled up the cover, and then just boom, it was gone. And it was almost like a magic trick. It was so strange. And this was a paperback. And obviously most of the books in the library were hardcovers. But I assume that the paper used in books is not, there's no fire retardant on it.
No. Yeah.
But it also made me understand what the fire department described to me as an extreme fire load, meaning that the library had more flammable material per square foot than really any other building. So this was a particularly hazardous place for a fire to begin. And at that time, the books in the stacks were in what really functioned as a chimney. They were these square building, or rather almost like little sub-units within the building that went up to the very top of the building, but they didn't have floors which serve as a fire break normally. You know, a fire might start on the first floor and it hits the ceiling and it stops. What it had was metal shelving going up 7 tiers. So the fire could just go straight up, which it did. And there was absolutely nothing to stop it. And this chimney essentially worked to cause the temperature of the fire to just rise almost unimaginably.
I've never read anything like this. I've never had fire, the color, the smell, the feel of it ever be described in quite this way. It is remarkable.
Thank you.
You've done us all kind of a service to have this kind of history written down. And there are so many heroes in the book. I don't know how many librarians we have with us now, but they are truly the heroes of the book. When you talk about men and women who have dedicated their lives to helping people find information, to being able to dress nicely and be in comfortable clothing, and what all of a sudden rolling up their sleeves and becoming like a wrecking crew, like all of a sudden lifting debris and having to show up to work not to sit comfortably, but have to really dig into a mess to save these books and to save this building. What of the former librarians and ones that are still librarians that you interviewed, how vivid for them were the memories of that day?
It was as if it had just happened. I spoke to one librarian who said to me that it was as if she was as devastated as the day Kennedy was assassinated. It was so traumatic that it remained so vivid. And people remembered the smell of the place, mm-hmm. the feel of it. I mean, you can imagine going to your workplace that is filled with the collection that you've built. I mean, librarians don't just sit there and stamp your mm-hmm. due date. They don't even do that. But they build these collections. I mean, thousands of books are published every week, and they're sorting through and picking the books that will be the most useful to have in the library. And they don't buy them all. They're choosing and trying to develop collections that are useful and valuable. Their work was simply gone.
Yeah.
And years of work just destroyed. And one thing that I think tells you everything about librarians is the number of them who were traumatized because they couldn't serve their patrons. And they were really worried about what would happen to the people who were used to coming to the library. Mm-hmm. They were... the city hired a psychologist to meet and do grief counseling with the librarians and to help them deal with the trauma of the fire. And many of them talked about that they were worried about their patrons and what were they doing while the library was closed. And the psychologist said, well, they're probably at a branch. It's okay. but it gives you a sense of how... people become librarians not because they will become rich and famous.
Yeah, there's a public service aspect that's incredible. And there's a sense in the book where you just don't know. I mean, of course, I read it knowing that the library survives. But it felt for a minute like, I don't know that this building is going to come back.
Yeah.
So I can imagine the heartbreak of trying to save something, worrying about your patrons, and not really knowing if this can be salvaged.
Well, it was interesting because for the prior 25 years, there had been ongoing controversy about mm-hmm. what to do with this building, and it was this close to being torn down. This would have been the equivalent of Penn Station in New York, an architectural gem mm-hmm. that got torn down. It was too small. It was in very bad condition, and in mm-hmm. the 60s, there was a report that the city released saying the building was basically derelict and inadequate, and it should be torn down. Well, and by the way, there was absolutely no architectural preservation body in Los Angeles at that time. Mm-hmm. The Los Angeles Conservancy began as an effort to save this library.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So in a way, yes,
thank
that
you.
Is a cause for, you know, we can actually look at what has happened in the preservation of important buildings in Los Angeles
because of this.
Because of the library. Yeah. What happened was a group of architects, hearing that this report was recommending that this building be torn down, formed a group that advocated to save this building, got the landmark status mm-hmm. that was really one of the important obstacles to tearing it down. And they really worked tirelessly to make sure the building was preserved and try to figure out how can it be adapted, because it was too small. Mm-hmm. And it had fallen into disrepair. And one of my favorite artifacts that I found, there was no air conditioning in the library. And there was a rule here that when the temperature reached 95 degrees inside, the library would be closed. So not 95 outside, 95 in the building. And it was incredibly hot. Because the wiring was very outdated, they would plug in fans and it would sort of blow out all of the circuitry because they had too many fans going. And a lot of the windows were wired shut because people used to steal books by throwing them out the windows. So the librarians were so irritated by it that they would wire them shut. And the librarians in the history department kept a log showing what the temperature was day after day. And the entries, I mean, looking back on it, they are hilarious.
Are they adding color to it?
Yes. It's like, it's boiling hot. This is unacceptable. It's humid. People are angry. And then the next day it would be, and the final entry is thermometer stolen.
Of course. Well, there are also so many unsung heroes in this book. I didn't know the thing about freezing books to save them from water damage, from mold, and that I guess the library had this kind of deal with the Bonaventure Hotel, that they would frequently, if a few books got water in them, they would put them in their big hotel freezer.
Right, right.
But then during this time, there was not enough room in 86, so the local fishing industry had huge freezers.
Yeah.
And so the books went in with the fish?
Yes.
I love it.
700,000 books that were, I mean, they had to be put somewhere. That's a lot of books. And they needed to be frozen because a wet book will begin molding within 48 hours.
Yeah.
And if they mold, they're gone.
They're done.
So they had to find a very big freezer for this almost a million books to be stored. And nobody knew how long it would take.
Yeah.
And no one really knew what to do with them once they were frozen. So they were stored with, you know, frozen vegetables and fish in the, you know, in the frozen food depots. And they were there for many years, actually.
And what I take from that, along with the stories of regular people who just showed up, out there, fifth and flower, and like, what can we do? That to me, as a person who's lived in Los Angeles now for 20 plus years, that to me so spoke to the spirit of the city.
Yeah.
And the spirit of the city in ways that it does not get enough credit for.
Right.
It was just so I was also curious, like, what are, the telethon also had me in stitches. That was one of my favorite anecdotes. And I have to say something about this, and then I want to hear one of your favorite anecdotes. The celebrity telethon, where Red Buttons, former Governor Pat Brown, Angie Dickinson, Pat Riley, Ernest Borgnine, Dinah Shore read from The Prince of Tides, Charlton Heston read from Moby Dick. First of all, a telethon with people reading.
Right.
Let's just be there. But then Zsa Zsa Gabor shows up with no book.
Right.
This is such a snapshot of LA in the 80s.
Yeah.
Also, it's absolutely wonderful. And I'm curious if you had like some favorite anecdotes about the people that kind of stepped in to help out.
Well, I have to admit, I also am kind of partial to the story, the Save the Books telethon. And the Master of Ceremonies, and I'm sure if any of you have lived here for any length of time, this name will be familiar to you, Reverend Gene Scott.
Yes, yes.
Was the Master of Ceremonies, and he was well known for running the church that was just down the street here, and he was somebody, I don't know why this is one of my favorite anecdotes, when he had this immensely popular preaching show that, you know, he was a televangelist,
yeah,
an early televangelist, and he would talk into the camera, and he would sometimes be preaching and sometimes just insulting people, saying, you know, if you don't donate, this was a quote from him, if you don't donate money to me, you should stand on your head and throw up. And, you know, he was not your typical preacher. And he offered to hold the telethon at the church because they had a huge theater. And he had a band called the Unbanned that usually played.
Where is this man now? I mean, is he still
with
us?
Well, he's 8 feet under, but
they gave him an extra 2 feet.
Yeah,
to make sure he was really
to make sure he was way gone. And you know, it was a moment that you don't think of in L.A., where the chairman of ARCO danced to Just a Gigolo, and Red Buttons is reading, and Gene Scott is preaching and having Beatles covers being played by his band. And in the meantime, it was all in an effort to raise $10 million to replace the books. This is the amazing, unfortunate fact that I came across, which was the insurance that the library had was on the building and not on the contents. So, and the building was relatively, it was dirty and sooty and there were holes, but the real loss was the books. And that wasn't covered by the insurance. So it was the city of Los Angeles that rallied and raised the money to replace those books. Everyone from kids who were doing penny drives to individual philanthropists, the Getty Foundation, people donating over the course of a year or two to reach this $10 million goal. They needed $20 million to really replace the collection, but the Save the Books campaign was to raise $10 million, and they succeeded.
It's a lovely city. It's a very sweet city. And speaking of that and its history, one of the other obvious, and I want to get to Harry. I want to get to our suspect in the suspected arson. But one of the things that was also so fascinating about this book was the history of the founding, basically, of the LA Public Library. So its beginning was a reading room. Am I getting that right? In a dance hall, in a social club called Amigos del País.
Right.
And you had to pay $5 a year. This is 1873.
So it was a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. And so you had to pay that just to belong to the club to be able to read in the reading room?
Right. And, you know, this is something that is such a impossible notion for us to imagine, that you have to pay to use the library. I can't remember do you pay a dollar to get a library card here?
Mm-mm.
Or maybe you pay nothing. I know in some cities you pay a dollar just to cover the cost of the actual card. But it was a membership. You had to belong, and you can imagine that the membership was not extended to women and not extended to children, and it was really just for men.
And then within decades, though, you have, let me get her name right, you have Mary Foy, who's 18 years old, who is the librarian of the city in a short period of time. In a brief way, I want you guys to read it all, but in a brief way, how did we get from this reading room in 1873 to this young woman who's the city librarian of an actual now part of the municipality of the city?
Well, that was the huge leap.
Yeah.
Was there was a group that formed after the original reading room was closed, and you know, libraries were really important in California. There weren't that many books out here. Mm-hmm. There were books in the missions, but there just weren't a lot of books out here. So an association formed of leading figures and citizens in the city, which wasn't much of a city, but there were people who formed this association with the intention of founding a library. It was set up originally in the Downey Block, which I don't think exists anymore as the Downey Block, but it was
That's not where
where the slave auctions were held. And it was in a storefront. Yeah. It was in a storefront. Then it moved a couple of times as it outgrew these storefronts. But what was amazing is that women had a very, very limited access. They were allowed to go in one room, which had a minimal amount of material. They weren't allowed to use the main library. And yet, the head of the library, among the very first heads of the library, was this young woman, Mary Foy.
18.
And she was 18 years old. Her dad would come and walk her to and from work, which is amazing. She was running the library. And it was, at that point, it had transitioned from being a private institution to being a city department, although it was a very small department. And actually, women ran the library here early in the library's history, at a point when women were still not really given access to most of the material in the library, which is very
insane,
weird.
But, but strangely...
And actually, one of my favorite sections of the book was writing about the Great Library War, which took place here in 1905, when a woman who had been running the library for a number of years very successfully was called in by the library commissioners and told that she should resign because she should certainly agree that it would be better to have a man run the library. And she said, well, actually, I don't agree. And she refused to resign, and it triggered a war that actually lasted for quite a while, and leading suffragettes appeared in Los Angeles. Thousands of women were marching in the streets and protesting the firing of Mary Jones.
It's time to talk about Harry. Harry Peek, the accused arsonist who was sued by the city and then who countersued them over the accusations. I'm not going to give anything away. This is a huge mystery about what really happened on that day in 1986. But in looking at him and the portrait painted of him, what do you see? Do you see villain or misunderstood Californian eccentric?
I don't see a villain. I absolutely don't see a villain. I think he was a dreamer and a fabulist and a liar and a sort of bumbling, the kind of person who makes jokes about bombs when they're in an airport.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, does that sort of person occasionally put a bomb on a plane, or are they just stupid making jokes about bombs on airplanes? And Harry was in many ways an iconic kind of California figure to me.
Yes, he is.
Somebody who grew up in Santa Fe Springs, dreamed of being a movie star, wanted to get out of the rather straight and narrow path that was being offered to him in a place like Santa Fe Springs, wanted to be a movie star, which meant that he moved to L.A., which seemed like a whole other universe, had no acting experience, learned that he had stage fright, and nibbled along the edges of Hollywood. He drove a limousine. Mm-hmm. He parked cars at the Sheraton. He just sort of made do. And yet, in his own mind, he was living a glamorous life.
Mm-hmm.
I think just being around in the... within the radiant field of Hollywood, he felt enlarged by it. he also then enlarged his own stories of his life.
Yes, to his family.
And friends, yeah, they would say, how was your day? He'd say, oh, it was great. I had lunch with Cher. You know, I just went to happy hour with Burt Reynolds. And that was, he was a storyteller. But unfortunately, he sometimes told stories that got him in big trouble. And he told a lot of people that he had set the building on fire.
Two questions. One, how difficult is it for you as a writer to suspend any kind of judgment of a character like that? How do you write a character who people over here are saying he did it, people over here are saying he didn't, and he's also odd, and it's so easy to blame odd people for odd things like setting a library on fire. But what was it like to write him and find a way to suspend judgment, or did you even feel that you had to?
I think my experience as a journalist, or maybe I should say this differently. I think I became a journalist because I don't feel compelled to make judgments. Mm. I'm compelled to hear as many versions of the story as I can hear. And it may be that because I'm a journalist, I'm very used to feeling open to the variety of the versions of reality and truth that we end up hearing. In his case, I certainly wanted to be able to say, this is the through line, this is the story, this is exactly what happened. It still was interesting to me the book is about storytelling, and certainly the number of versions and iterations of the story that were being... I mean, Harry ended up with 7 different alibis, which if you plan to commit a crime, I'd suggest you stick with one alibi. And there were moments when I thought, should I tell the reader what the answer is? Mm-hmm. Or is it sufficient to say, these are all the versions of the story that I followed, that I grew to understand, and which adventure you choose is open to you to interpret. Because the fact is, none of us know really what happened. And
may I ask you this, though? You can refuse to answer, but do you think he was here that day?
That's a tough one. I mean, there is certainly evidence that suggests that he was, because there were things he knew that you wouldn't have known unless it was an incredible coincidence. And yet, he was not, from anything else I learned about him, he was not a library goer. But then again, and this may be different now, and I know there are surveillance cameras in the library for safety reasons.
Yes.
In 1986, there were not.
Yeah.
So there was no way to know.
Other than eyewitness.
Yeah.
I saw a blonde dude who might have been him, might not have been him.
You come in and out of the library absolutely without... You don't register. You don't sign in.
Don't want that. Nobody wants that. That's not That's not in the spirit of what libraries are.
Right.
And I think the mystery of it is part of the engine of the book. I think part of wanting to keep going on is one chapter you're like, he totally did it. Another chapter you're like, wait a second, I don't really know. I don't really know. I know we've got to, it's about time to do questions. There's something I, as a writer, have to ask you before we open it up to the group. I have to quote something that you said, because when I read it, I gasped. You wrote in the book that right before learning about the library fire, I had decided I was done writing books. Tell me where this came from, and what, after writing this book, are your next plans? Do you still feel the same way?
When I finished Rin Tin Tin, my last book, I was really exhausted.
Yeah.
It had been, I don't pick easy subjects. In fact, I pick subjects where most of the time I'm trying to figure out what the subject is. So it's a almost day-to-day re-examination all the time. What am I writing about? Why am I writing it? Why would anyone else care about this subject? So it's sort of exhausting. And Rin Tin Tin was a tough book to write. It was a huge amount of reporting. When it was done, I thought, I'm done. I don't have to write any more books. I'm done. I did it. I'm finished. And I wasn't saying I don't want to write anymore, but I really felt drained and felt that I just had been wrestled to the ground by the process of writing the book. So it speaks volumes, not to make a pun, but that I couldn't resist this one because I really didn't, you know, a friend of mine said, friends don't let friends write books. And I remember when I said to her, no, this one will be easy. And she just said, oh, boy. But I think that it was an instance where the story so captured me. And all of these things kind of coming together, you know, being new to Los Angeles and finding this as a way of getting to know the city, which it certainly was, really coming to terms with the issue of my mom's dementia and losing her memory and thinking about all of the time we had spent at the library together and grappling with that. And finding out about the fire, and you know, I had begun thinking, wow, libraries are amazing. It would be really interesting to write about a year at a library. And then I thought, Susan, stop. Like, don't do this. And then hearing about the fire and being so, I just was so astonished. Yeah. I couldn't believe I had never heard about it.
Yeah.
And I was living in New York when it happened, but I still thought, how did I not hear about this?
Yeah.
This is a major event. It's an event that someone interested in the world of books would have certainly heard about.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was a reason that I hadn't heard about it, which was one of those moments where I thought, all right, I have to write this book. It's just too irresistible.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to ask you one, as they gather, I guess someone's gathering all of the questions up and we'll hand them down. How did you come up with the chapter headings or these are book titles, and they're like card catalog numbers, and they correspond with the chapter that's coming in kind of obvious ways, but in esoteric kind of ephemeral ways too. How did you come up with those book titles to be put at the beginning of every chapter?
It's actually very funny. I was writing a section about a wonderful city librarian named Althea Warren, who was a reading evangelist, and she would say to people, you know, lie to your friends, don't go out to dinner, stay home and read a book, and just tell them you have a headache.
Yeah,
and
I'm down with that.
Yeah, she was an amazing figure. And at one point, I came across a quote where she was saying, you know, what you should do is lie to your aunt and say you can't come to dinner and stay home and read Lucy Gayheart. And I thought, I wonder if that's a real book. So I went to the catalog and I looked up Lucy Gayheart, which it is, in fact, a real book by Willa Cather. And then I just started, you know how it is. You're in the catalog and you just think, oh, I wonder what else Willa Cather. And then it's like, oh, I wonder if there are any other books named Lucy Gayheart. And then it's like hours go by and you've been, and part of it was just thinking, oh my God, there are so many. I bet I can't think of a single topic that there isn't a book in the library about
it.
And I was like gravestones in Kentucky. It was like gravestones, gravestones in Kentucky, 301.7. And I thought, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So there was just something that made me want to capture the kind of breadth of the library, the artifactualness of the library, and it became an incredibly enjoyable process to choose the books for each
chapter.
Did
you do it at the end? After the
I did it.
Was
I was about three quarters of the way done when I suddenly thought, I'm doing this. So I went back and did them and then continued through the rest of the book. But it was really fun to do. And it really was remarkable. I never thought of a single topic that there weren't multiple books about. Like, I think, I know it's going to be, you know, literacy and, you know, some very specific aspect of literacy. And then, of course, there are 20 books.
Yeah.
So part of it is to remind people of that great wealth of that exists here. Part of it was to capture in some visual way that sense of this.
Looking on the shelf.
Yeah,
kind of,
exactly.
Yeah.
And this, that you're pulling this story off the shelf with each chapter.
Yeah. This is, I think, a fantastic question. What are your thoughts about libraries going digital and the strengths and vulnerabilities that this opens up for the communal brain?
Well, libraries already have embraced the internet and digitization, and I think they've done it in a very smart way. I mean, rather than digging their heels in and saying, no, we're not having anything to do with this, they've really embraced it and used it. I mean, the number of books that are loaned out as e-media is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge part of what the library does. I think that in the future, and I'm certainly not an expert on libraries or the future of libraries, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that the libraries will move into the future as these two distinct things. Mm-hmm. One is the physical place. It's a place. I mean, mm-hmm. libraries are places, and the more they are enriched as places, the more we will choose to use them the way we maybe now use coffee shops public parks, or, you know, that they will become community centers more and more. And we're really entering a world in which many people don't work in offices anymore.
Yeah.
And they may...
Especially in L.A.
Right.
Yeah.
And that working in a library is a perfect way to use that space.
Yeah.
And then they exist in that digital world where they are the repositories of all of this information that can be accessed from home mm-hmm. or from here, and they're mutable in a different way because they're digitized. But libraries also have a huge amount of material that can't be digitized or simply won't be for a very mm-hmm. long time. So there remains a reason to come to this place for information.
And just you get a vibe, kind of, I feel like, when you come and other people are working and you're in a cubicle next to them in a study carrel. It you know, it does kind of uplift your own kind of consciousness.
I was working at home on the book, and then I just got completely sick of working at home. So I rented space in a co-working space. And one day, for whatever reason, I wasn't going to make it over to the co-working space. So I thought, well, I don't know. I'll go work at the library. And as I'm working at the library, I thought, why am I paying for this stupid co-working space? The only real difference is that they had a keg of beer that was always available. And I'm not sure that's absolutely the best thing for a working space anyway. But the only thing that it had a greater asset to the co-working space is they had really good coffee. And the coolest library I visited in the course of doing this book was in Denmark, and they had amazing coffee. And everybody came to the library for the coffee. So that's just, that is my one plea with the Los Angeles Public Library is have really good coffee. But yes, yes. But it's, I think that we will come to value the library as a place while taking great advantage of its enormous resources that are online, and I don't see those in conflict.
Good. Yeah, I completely agree. Do we have time for two more or one more? Anybody? I told you, Libby, I need my glasses. Two more, great. What are you reading right now?
I'm reading Washington Black.
I'm sorry, I just came out of my chair. I love this book so much. Please, everybody, go read it. Isn't it fantastic?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's Eddie...
Essie Adjujian.
Yeah.
I'm going to take credit for the fact that she was on NPR this morning because Steve Inskeep asked me what's coming out and what novel, and I told him about it.
And she was great.
She was incredible. That book is so good, you guys.
It's
adventure. It's psychological study. It's sociological study. I just got really excited. I'm sorry I came out of my chair. But I was really sad she did not win the Booker today. I got a little bummed about that. But
yeah, but it's wonderful. And I read mostly fiction in my spare time, unless I'm reading. I just got a ukulele, so I'm going to get a handbook for ukulele. I don't know that that's reading, but it is a book.
Let me ask you about your relationship to The New Yorker. I know some of, do you read the articles that you didn't write?
Never.
Oh. So I don't feel bad if I have a subscription and I maybe get to one good article every three editions.
You know, this
editions.
Is the great myth. If you work at The New Yorker, people think you have read every article and every issue. And they apologize always. I'm so sorry. I'm 6 months behind. And
I gave up.
I'm 6 years behind. I've been writing a book.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just now dipping into 1997. So, and I don't read my own stories. So that it's not even as if I'm reading my stories and then throwing the magazine over my shoulder. But I read a lot. I do read a lot, but I read a lot of fiction especially when I'm writing, because I just need a little break from nonfiction.
So, can we expect a film adaptation 2 from this book?
Well, that would be interesting to call it adaptation 2.
Where's Spike Jones?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm quite at liberty to give the details, but I think it'll be pretty interesting to see Meryl Streep as a librarian.
That would be incredible, running. But then it's got to turn into an action movie, and she gets a big fire hose and puts it all out.
Yeah, all right, we got it. In fact, we should start filming right now. We've got it figured out.
Susan, I want to thank you for, I find this building very special. I brought my daughter here. I've researched every single book I've written in this building. I find this place to be, like I said, holy and special. And I feel like you have done the city of Los Angeles and the Los Angeles Public Library a great service to have written this down. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you
so much.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.